When I think what to say, I'm facing this kind of impossible task. Especially in this context of Sesshin and Zen practice. Always when you choose one path to explain or talk, you kind of close out other paths at that point. It would be wonderful if we could just say it all at once, all levels and dimensions and layers, everything would be revealed at once. Not going here and there and forgetting things and messing up with sentences and in a way causing a unnecessary thoughts even. This would be a wonderful way if we could speak like this. Everything was there. No, from A to B, just. Because we live like that. We live like this. This is our real life. Moment to moment life. But when we go up in the heads and start to think hard, we create this illusion of past and present and future from place A to place B, for example. And since this head is, I mean, thinking mind is so, has so much influence, we kind of, perhaps we live our daily life a little bit like one leg is there somewhere. Not exactly here, a little bit over there, going or coming somewhere. But the same practice, Sesshin, really tries its best to show us that there is nowhere else to go. This is this waking up thing. Oi, oh, ah, it's here. Oi, oi. What I've been thinking. But it doesn't end there. It doesn't end there. And then we have Dharma. We have this teaching. So many layers again. Then we have Zen Buddhism that teaches in its own unique way. Kind of more directly, perhaps pointing than explaining. Encouraging us really to become what we are, to be, to feel, to live what we already are doing and living. Already. But there are challenges. There are challenges. Even though we, in theory, we know these things, we know that it's here. We know, intellectually at least, that the truth is perhaps it is just this. But we are not 100% sure. Or we don't feel it. We really don't feel it. We don't see it. And when that's the case, like it is, we try maybe to imagine what it should be or like to be. And for granted, we can't do that successfully. We can't think what is our true life. It's a funny situation, but also same time very tragic thing. Maybe in the modern world or contemporary world, we could say that the challenge is not, of course, it's not that we are stupid, so that we don't understand this practice, or we have enough capacity for doing this. It's not really our bodies either. We can sit differently if it's too painful to sit cross-legged, and we could even lie down. Maybe not in Zendo, not this small Zendo, but you get the point. Of course it needs some tolerance to tolerate with uncomfortable feelings in our bodies, some pain. That can be difficult for sure. But maybe not only physical pain. It also often comes with feelings, thoughts, kind of mental material, mental anguish. And I guess there it is, what is the most challenging part of this practice. If we truly would like to practice this practice, if we really would like to learn all there is to learn, not just run after some experiences of being here and now, which is of course important too, but if we really would like to walk the path like Buddha did, then it would include everything, all the aspects in human life. And then it wouldn't be just for me. That is something, of course, that becomes obvious when we do practice. Like was this African proverb, if you want to go fast, go alone. Sometimes we have to do that. Sometimes it's crucial to be fast and go alone. But in this practice, if I'm just thinking, I want to proceed fast, I want to do this quickly, I want to examine this Zen, I want to be graduated and move on. Maybe that works for some courses of Zen you could do like that, but then the rest wouldn't work. Because that's like the proverb continues, if we want to go far. If we really want to go far and deep, go together. We understand that this comes from the time when it was more safe and secure and to walk, to proceed with the other people, so you could be supported. But also, we could turn this a little bit around, since now we are in Zen context, and we could say that we are losing ourselves little by little while doing this practice. Little by little. Just a little chip here and there will disappear. And it's a very slow process, I think. But within every of those little chips that falls away, we start to see this togetherness thing. It's a kind of artificial thing to be a separate self. It's a very powerful illusion. But at the end of the day, it is an illusion. But the challenge is, even if I would like to open up, I would like to be together, I would like to feel that, I would like to see how it is, it's difficult. So one little koan, I'm just reading it through now, not much. I think this could be one. I had this fantasy that it would be nice to say everything at once, but it's impossible. So maybe this little koan from Mumonkan, Daitsu Shiso Buddha, could be one color, one taste, one flavor that we have in this one and whole, only one pie of Zen practice. So once a monk asked Master Seijo of Koyo, Daitsu Shiso Buddha, the Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom, did sasen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas, but could neither manifest the Dharma nor attain Buddhahood. Why was this? Seijo said, "Your question is exactly to the point." The monk persisted. Why did he not attain Buddhahood by doing sasen on the Bodhi seat? Seijo replied, "Because he didn't attain Buddhahood." So this supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom Buddha still couldn't attain Buddhahood, even though he sat there 10 kalpas. This is a one aspect of our practice, or our life, perhaps. I've been in this many sessions and still, I don't know, I haven't got it yet. I haven't got it yet, really. Why? Because I didn't attain Buddhahood. So, we are humans, we probably have this taste in our mouths that more, I would like to have some more. This was good, but not enough. Also, we might think that now I nailed it. I nailed it. I alone, perhaps, made it through. no one else has seen how marvelous it is really. Sometimes we might get lost with those kind of fantasies, sad fantasies. That's why we come back again and again. We humbly sit down on our cushion and we start to focus, we start to be one with this in front of us, within our bodies. In some sense, one way to say what the treasure really is everything that has been there on the path. It's not just the very end somewhere there, but it's every step we take. Every breath we have is the treasure. But if we try to look some far away thing, we miss, most likely we will miss this treasure here and now. I have this English version of Zazen Vasan, the Hakuin Sensei's song of Zazen. And this is not from the Rochester book, chant book. It's a little bit different translation. But just let's start from the start and just a few lines from there. Hakuin Eikaku, Hakuin Sensei, of course, he was amazing Zen master and he did all his tricks, so to say, to help us. And like in this case, he really put all his skills there to write the song of Zazen, which, as we have understood, is based on really some song. I mean, the melody line and the form of that he used. He just changed wordings and made it in this way very accessible for the folk. Sentient beings are primarily all Buddhas. It is like ice and water. Apart from water, no ice can exist. Outside sentient beings, where do we find the Buddhas? Outside of sentient beings, where do we find the Buddhas? Sentient beings are primarily all Buddhas. Not knowing how near the truth is, we seek it far away. What a pity. We are like a man who, in the midst of water, cries, "I'm thirsty." We are like the son of a rich man who wandered away among the poor. When we can see what he is here writing in this Song of Zazen, when we experience those things ourselves, when we get a glimpse of that, we could sing along with those words and knowing that they are true. They are exactly how it is. But when curtains are in front of our eyes and we don't see, it sounds just like blah, 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 blah. Beautiful words only. Typical religious words promising something bigger than life. I won't buy this. So it is a challenge to for us. We need words in order to feed our brain, to feed our thinking part of it. We need words so that, because we need words. But we just should digest them and then let them go. There's one koan I was going to actually use, really, even in this talk. Let's say if we have time for, we can start. And this comes from koan collection Hekigan Roku. And I just thought that it's about years exactly, but we could say roughly, because we don't know exactly where those episodes, those events really took place. We know when the collection was put together, but those actual, that they are referring to, they are older. So we could say these are 1,000 years old, 1,000 years old stories. So, relatively old. So it means something like at least 30 plus grandparents we could like put on a row standing there, and like maybe 35, who knows how many. It's a long, long queue of people that we were so long ago living, and we are direct ancestors of those people. So it is so far this book comes. 30-some generations. And this one is taking a place during the summer Ango period, training period, somewhere in China, 1,000 years ago. First introduction, and this I picked it up this. Because this is kind of dealing with the challenge of talking. I mean, having a teisho, this kind of talk. It deals with that. Introduction. Suikan's eyebrows is the case. I mean, the koan itself. The enlightened man enjoys perfect freedom in active life. He is like a dragon supported by deep waters, or like a tiger which commands its mountain retreat. The man who is not enlightened drifts about in the affairs of the world. He is like a ram which gets its horns caught in a fence, or like a man who waits for a rabbit, who waits for a rabbit to run against a tree stump and stun itself. So this was the unenlightened man, does those kind of activities. The enlightened man's words are sometimes like a lion crouched to spring sometimes like the Diamond King's treasure sword. Sometimes their effect is to shut the mouths of the world-famed ones. Sometimes it is as if they simply follow the waves coming one after another. When the enlightened man meets others who are enlightened, then friend meets friend. He values them, and they encourage each other. When he meets those who are adrift in the world, the teacher meets disciple. His way of dealing with such people is far-sighted. He stands firm before them, like a 1,000-fathom cliff. Therefore, it is said that the way of the Absolute is manifest everywhere. It has no fixed rules and regulations. The teacher sometimes makes a blade of grass stand for the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, and sometimes makes the golden-faced Buddha, 16 feet high, stand for a blade of grass. Tell me, on what principle is all this based? Do you understand? See the following is now pointing at to this case, the actual case of the koan. Let's read it. The case. At the end of the summer training period, Suigan spoke to the assembly, saying, "All summer long, I have been talking to you, brothers. Look and see if my eyebrows are still there." Hofuku said, "A thief has a guilty conscience." Shoke said, "They have grown." Umon said, "Kan," which means barrier. So this is there's many things going on, and we simply won't get it all done today. But here they talk, introduction talks about enlightened man and unenlightened man. Those are those two things we are kind of bumping up. Like sometimes we are here, sometimes we think we may be here. Maybe middle way is the best. Not too much enlightened, but little bit. So what are those words anyway telling us? In some traditions and some places, they are using these big words, E words. And some places they really are not, because of they are such a big words, having a so heavy loaded different meanings and such. So it's a kind of maybe risky business to use those words. But what can we do? I think ultimately this practice is about enlightenment, whatever it is. This is something we have to find out. It's not just a fancy word. Nor is it really some abstract, mystical world or concept or something. Again, depending on tradition and where we come from, it might have very different meanings, the word itself. But the little I know about the subject, and because we are in Zen, it kind of has knowable kind of what is it about? Where is it pointing at? We know that it doesn't really mean in Zen that we can, for example, fly without wings, or things like such. It probably doesn't mean those things. Perhaps those things exist, but in Zen context, they are not the most used ones anyway. So it's something very concrete here, this enlightenment thing. It's really concrete here and now thing. Something we could say very ordinary even. Very ordinary. What was the word that the one monk used? Was it the extraordinary? No, I can't remember, but it was... No. Anyways, and that's of course again a challenge. If it's something very ordinary, why then we have to sit here? Why we have to do this damn practice if it is very ordinary thing? It is because our false assumptions, our strange ideas about who and what I am, what we are. Too many words, simply. Too many stories, too many ideas about right and wrong, this and that. There were days when we were young, when we quite innocently touched this thing. But we weren't aware of it. That's one thing. We didn't know it. We just live it. Like nature. Like little birds, squirrels, deers. They don't know it. They just live through what it is. So there is, that is one important thing, I guess, is that there is this awareness, realization, kind of knowing it. This very ordinary thing. We kind of wake up to see this very ordinary thing, not just living it in the midst of everything and disappearing in different fantasies now and then, and being kind of in a dream. So the difference is very little in a way. But there is this, oh, now I see. Now I see. It was here all the time. But now I see it. I didn't see it before, even though it was in front of my eyes. Something like that is going on here. How can we see something that is in front of our eyes right now? We have our eyes open. I can't open them more. They will drop out. So it's not about our physical sense organ thing, because we see very well. I need glasses, though. We hear quite well. We taste, we have sensations, thoughts are running through our heads quite easily. So everything is functioning very well. That's not the problem. Everything is functioning Buddha great. Buddha well. So that's again is not the problem. So can we somehow trace it back to the source where the problem is kind of coming from? What is the problem? We can ask this. You can ask it yourself. while sitting there facing the wall. What is the problem? It is very useful to ask, what am I lacking for? What is my problem here? Why I am not happy? And I know it's kind of, because I would say I'm not happy because I'm in session. Otherwise I would be quite happy actually. But then we have to go a little bit deeper if possible. But you see the point. It's kind of the key for the whole, how can we call it? The key to open this treasure box is not elsewhere. It's not my in my hand. It's in your hand is the key. You have it. No one else can have it for you. You already have it. Now you have to find it. Where is the key? Who is the key? Where is the lock? What is the problem? So one thing before we end today is that there is some reality things that we can't really deny. And that is, traditional Zen doesn't talk about those things in these words, but I think in the West nowadays we more often kind of recognize that there is something very intimate in every one of in us. I mean, we have our fears, we have our wounds, so to say. They can be anything, but they come from our life we experienced in the past. Maybe we made a huge we understood it completely wrong when we were, let's say, child. Maybe nothing as bad happened as we thought. Maybe we just misunderstood some words that some person put on us, told to us, said to us. You know, those things. But I would not like to make those things too big in this practice. Not like make this practice into some kind of therapy session. But I think it is fair to acknowledge that sometimes those hindrances while we are sitting on a cushion is not about that we are stupid in any ways, or that we don't understand, or that we are kind of lacking some kind of enlightenment tool. We have it, but the challenge is that it's hard for us to be here and now. It's simply as that. It's hard to us to really feel how it feels in this body mind, in this back of skin and bones. And that is very intimate and a live thing we must face again and again also. So when I say that if we want to walk this path like entirely, like take it all, I think it's better if we really try to also live through all our shadows and wounds. It might take a long time because we work on those things, but it's worth. First, we might try to kind of sneak out from those things and trying to get to hit the bull's eye in somewhere there, but sooner or later those wounds will hit back. I mean, we can't make them disappear. We have to make them disappear only by being them, experiencing them again and again, embracing. So why I say this is just that this is very simple thing. I mean, we acknowledge we have some things that we are not, we don't like to feel, and we accept it. We take another breath, maybe we go a little bit closer, maybe we surrender one day more. And at the same time we do our practice. Our practice is to be this body, breathing body, being this breath, being this sound, being this smell of incense, being all this that is happening, being the pain here and there, being the dry mouth, being the stomach that wants to food, to get some food, being all that, embracing it, feeling it again and again, round after round. And then we ask, what is the problem? Who has the problem? Where is the problem? Can we really point it out? And you might be surprised. It's just maybe your little feeling there that is the problem. Nothing else. Okay, enough talking. May all beings attain the Buddha way.